Perhaps it should be negligence per se at all. He thinks that this is a bad rule, a poor rule. Your violation of statute should be one factor in determining whether or not you exercise reasonable care in circumstances like that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Thomas Kavanaugh, practicing in Portland, Oregon. My practice is primarily in the negligence, automobile, and defensive, like in my class insurance company cases, and primarily on the defense side, though I do have a certain number of plaintiff's cases. I wanted to speak particularly today on the Senate Bill 267, the last clear chance rule. Senator Lent mentioned one case in which the court recently rejected what he refers to as the majority opinion over the United States and adopted or stayed with in Oregon the minority opinion that the of discovered peril as distinguished from discoverable peril. Now, that, of course, has not been the only case that the Supreme Court has considered in the past few years. Two others that come quickly to mind are Knight A. Tomasini, decided in 1965. The citation of that case is 240 Oregon 589, and I participated in the appeal of that case. The court considered the matter extensively, not only hearing it in the initial instance, but calling us back for rehearing. And the adoption of the broader rule was rejected by the court in that case. The court had another opportunity in 1967 to do the same thing in the case of Rothrock versus McAllister. The citation of that case is 247 Oregon 545. And then in the fall of 1968, in the case of Goff versus Raddy, R-A-D-I, cited 87 Advantage 299. Considered the matter again and specifically rejected the discoverable peril theory. Now, I know in the case of Knight A. Tomasini, both sides of this question were presented to our Supreme Court, and I'm sure that both sides were extensively briefed and submitted to the court in the other cases. And frankly, from any standpoint of negligence law, I can see no justification for a change in the rule adopted by the court at this time. As a matter of fact, I think that it would put a defendant at a considerable peril to have to be in the position of discovering somebody that has violated the law or gotten away from the presumption that exists that a person doesn't need to anticipate somebody's violation of the law. And I don't believe that that's confused with lookout, because having once discovered the peril, then of course the actor is under duty to exercise reasonable care to avoid the peril that he has been confronted with. And we get in then to lookout, control, and whatever else is involved in the operation of his vehicle. We would also be subjected to a number of types of cases that simply don't exist now. I can think that perhaps every drunk that might wander out on the highway is to some extent a peril, and to put a motorist under a duty to discover each and every one of those things or each and every act of continuing negligence would be an unnecessary burden on the operator of the car. I wanted to comment on a couple of other of these. Does anybody have any questions on me so far as this one is concerned, or is it your pleasure that I continue through the end of them before?
You just as well comment on each of the bills in which you have an interest.
My other the bill in which I have another interest is the Senate Bill 277 to get a passenger law. Now,
you're in favor of that, aren't you, Mr. Campbell?
No, I'm not, Burns. And I say so rather than quick.
I have a short enough bill. I thought the short ones were
sometimes you're not.
I'm confused. Are you in favor of the law or in favor of the bill? He asked if you were in favor. You mentioned the guest factor law.
I'm in favor of the law as exists, and I object to the bill as well.
I see. Thank you.
If I understand historically the basis for the guest passenger laws we have, which is a creature of statute, and wouldn't exist but for statute, it was to lend some immunity in the exchange of the hospitality somebody arrived where that person is a pure guest. Now, I don't think in this day and age, with the increase and continued use of automobiles, that there is any basis for a change in the original thinking or theory by which the guest passenger was originally created. More and more people ride together in cars, and certainly the same justification exists to provide some slight immunity to one who does offer another person a ride without their remuneration and on a consent and host-guest relationship. I believe that the statute as it's now written sets out very clearly the standard that exists in Oregon since the last few cases that were decided, and spelling out the what constitutes payment or substantial benefit to take a person out of the guest statute is well set out and certainly has been subject to interpretation by the court. So I am opposed to a repeal of the guest passenger law. If I correctly added Senator Lent's number here of jurisdiction, we have 21 out of 50, and I believe that the rest of them do have some form of guest passenger law. Now, I wanted to make just one comment so far as Bill 483 is concerned, because I had something to do with McConnell versus Carroll. I apparently changed the law to some small extent and still lost the case, if that's possible. In McConnell versus Herron, in our arguments before the Supreme Court, and again, this was a case that was argued and then we were called back for re-argument, the court considered at length the difference that it felt logically existed between a statute on safety equipment or required equipment on a vehicle and one that was purely an operational hazard, and felt that there was such that there was a real distinction between the two. And McConnell versus Herron, in my interpretation of the case, particularly after having been questioned rather closely by various members of the court in argument, I felt was limited to the safety equipment or required equipment type situation without application of this highest degree of care to any other operational or any other facet of negligence in a person operating the car. From that standpoint, and McConnell versus Herron did involve brakes, and on a truck, which requires two sets, that I felt the distinction does and should continue to exist insofar as a person's operation of the car as distinguished from how it's equipped. For that reason, I also oppose 483. I don't believe that the need is justified, nor an attempt should be made to place operational negligence or negligence arising out of operation on the same patrol with a statute which sets forth what the safety of equipment must be on the car. And that's all I have.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Cooney? We'll follow the same
Tom Cooney, I'm an attorney. I practice in Portland, Oregon with the firm of Morrison & Bailey, and with the firm that specializes primarily in defense insurance claims. In regard to Senator Lent's bill regarding the last clear chance doctrine, I oppose the adoption of this bill for the following reasons. First of all, the last clear chance doctrine is a legal device to avoid the defense of contributory negligence, which would bar the plaintiff from recovering. And that bar will stand and prohibit recovery under the present Oregon law unless, as it now reads, the defendant, who was the last person that was negligent, actually discovered the peril and failed to do anything about it. This is a good rule. What we're trying to adopt now is a rule that simply says the last man that was negligent is the one that must pay. Senator Lent's objection to the applying different standards of, for instance, of lookout, what you actually saw and what you might have seen, is not well taken, because the way the bill is drawn now, the amendment, what you are doing is excusing the plaintiff or the person who put himself in the perilous situation from his neglect in failing to discover for knowing what he should have discovered. And you are making the defendant then liable for those things which he actually discovered or should have discovered. So, in effect, this amendment actually puts a greater burden on the defendant to look out for the original negligent person who originally created the situation. And it is inherently unfair. And as Mr. Kavanaugh has indicated, this has been reviewed many times by the Oregon Supreme Court and they consistently rejected it. The other thing of consideration to it is you are going to get an increase in the number of cases that will be filed in connection with that. In regard to Senate Bill 457, which I understand is the Love and Affection Amendment to the Death Statute for the Death of a Child, I think only this comment can be made. Sometimes we mistakenly believe that we must compensate in dollars for every loss that occurs. The loss of a child, love and affection, should not appropriately be the item of money compensation. We're not in a society where we can compensate for each and every type of loss.
I was going to ask you what you thought the insurance company should do in that case.
You can use the pecuniary loss, such as they do in the death of a spouse, for instance, where you can put a pecuniary value on assistance, education, companionship, those things. But even in the death of a spouse, you're not compensating an adult spouse. You're not compensating for love and affection. These items, I do not think, are just philosophically should appropriately be an item of compensable money damage. Perhaps this is the type of loss that is not within the realm of the law of compensation. The other thing is what kind of proof do you put on to prove the value of the loss of love and affection of a child? My only remark is that perhaps this type of item is not within the realm of compensable loss. There's no money in the world to restore that. And perhaps we cheapen it by trying to put a dollar sign. Now, in regard to 477, the joinder of the child's claim for the personal injury with the parent's claim for loss of medicals, I think this would be a good bill. I would encourage its adoption with the stipulation.
What number of that bill?
477. This would be the one where the parent is allowed to join with the claim for the injury to the child, the claim for medical expense. As a practical matter, this is done frequently by agreement between the attorneys, and it cuts down the necessity of additional litigation. And I think that if you protected the defendant from being exposed to a double exposure of two causes of action, which you do in this bill by filing an election, this would eliminate the necessity of additional lawsuits. And what you get into, the way it's at least in Multnomah County, the parent files the claim now and joins with a claim for medical. It can be stricken on motion of the defense if they elect to do so, and this requires the filing of another lawsuit. And this type of bill would be good for relief of congestion.
Todd, you're saying that you would
Yes, I would, however, recommend the omission. Yes, I would recommend the omission of the loss of services case. I don't think you should include that. And I'd like to recommend that. 478, which was the bill that he proposed allowing a postponement of trial, even though the other side may agree that if your absent witness was present, you would testify according to your affidavit. But this is a good bill, and I would recommend its passage. From the defendant's standpoint,
which one did you say?
478. From the defendant's standpoint, with our courts currently trying to keep their dockets as current as they can, frequently the application for a continuance because of the unavailability of the witness is denied, because when the statutory showing is made and the claimant says, all right, I'll agree that this witness, if you were called, would say so, you're forced out to trial because the courts are being pressed to make their dockets current. If this happens to the plaintiff and the statute of limitations has been run, he can take a voluntary non-suit and get the case off the docket and have his trial with his witness. This is not available to the defense, and this would give the trial court a discretion in the appropriate case to allow a defendant who has a meritorious claim to have in court before a jury a live witness. And those of us who try cases, I'm sure, are very aware of the value of the presence of the witness live to testify. So this, I think, would be a very...
Statute of limitations, Mr. Chairman, can be a problem there. Would you say make them take a voluntary...
Yes, the plaintiff, if before the statute of limitations is run, he gets forced out to trial, he can take a voluntary lawsuit and refile. Even after the statute is run, if he proceeds to trial, puts on part of his evidence, he could make the same motion and then the discretion of the court can grant it, and then, even though the statute may have run, if the trial is commenced, he can start putting on evidence. No, I think you have to leave that to the discretion of the courts. The courts are being very careful about keeping cases current. And I don't think you have to worry about the situation of just laying in dormant forever. You might get restrictions from the court. Well, it's an expert test, expert witness, dead or something. They'll say, get enough, have them ready in 30 days. I don't think you should put a mandatory requirement or limitation. Article 43, negligence is a matter of law. I would oppose the adoption of this bill. I see a real justification for a different rule in negligence as a matter of law when you're dealing with safety statutes regarding mechanical equipment and those where you're judging the operational ability of the driver to drive a car. The higher standard for maintaining your vehicle in top condition is designed to encourage people to maintain the vehicles well, keep their brakes up and so on. Whereas the test of the operation of the vehicle and the circumstances on the highway deals so much more with split-second decisions and so on. So there, I think on the one you're judging mechanical, the ability you have to maintain the mechanical condition of the car, and the standard there can justify it would be higher, making it the highest degree of care. Whereas insofar as the operational aspect of driving a car in violation of the statute should recognize the rapidity with which things happen and so on, and therefore there's a basis. This test should be a lesser one. Now, just one other remark in regard to this statute. I speak strictly in my own regard on this. The guest statute, probably, is a statute which is lost much of its meaning today, like the death limitation did some years ago. It may not make any sense anymore. However, one of the things that the committee must bear in mind if we do, in effect, consider throwing out the guest statute is that it has been in effect in Oregon for many years. And to change it is going to increase the number of claims that arise, and this will in turn increase the cost of insurance. Now, the question that you must determine then as a committee is do the people of the state of Oregon who have lived under this law for this length of time want this change sufficiently to expose themselves again to this ever-increasing insurance rate? And this, I think, is one of the primary problems.
Have any impact tables?
No, I'm sorry. I think that's all the remarks.
Thank you. Red Smith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ned Smith, Farm Insurance Group.
I think merely instead of reading this whole statement, which I will pass out to save time, the clerk can make additional copies to give to everyone. My comment very quickly, however, on the only Oregon case that really touches on it, which is a 1935 case and has been repeatedly upheld. Quote, justice requires that no one undertakes to perform a duty gratuitously this is a Washington case that's referred to, should not be under the same obligation as one who enters upon the same undertaking for pay. The Oregon case says, specifically, guest statutes have merely placed in statutory form what some courts and the public generally have recognized as just and salutary rules concerning the liability of a host toward an invited passenger in his automobile. This case goes on and cites a California case and the language in that, which refers to the rule of dog fighting, the hand that feeds it, etc. So I'm not going to read all that or burden the committee with the time. I thought perhaps so some other elements should be mentioned. Most auto policies contain auto medical pay coverage. Our agents are instructed not to quote liability rates without it. Some companies will not write policies without it. Most guest passengers are indemnified at least to this extent. Passage of this bill would permit them to recover not only for this medical coverage, which the host paid for, but for medical expenses and general damage as well in a lawsuit. The cost of insurance is determined by the amount the companies have to pay in claims. If this bill is enacted, the cost will go up. The United States, through the Department of Transportation, is now conducting a study of insurance costs and practices. The rising cost of insurance is a problem. This study will have been completed before the next session of this legislature. At that time, we may have to consider several changes in the tort system and in auto insurance laws. But I would not recommend any changes at this time, or any changes such as this bill enact.
Would you leave those statements with us?
Yes, I'll leave. There's one and a copy. That case I quoted there, the whole case is there, and there's one copy each of the quotations I referred to. Let's see, there's some others I didn't sign up for, but I think perhaps if I may briefly comment upon. Consolidation of these minor cases, I would agree, of loss of services.
What, give us the number.
477, I'm sorry.
477.
I think for the intent, Senator Lent described it as right. However, I think it might work a hardship against the child if the loss of service claim had to be included in it. There was talk, I think, by Senator Lent and others that part should be removed. The other one that I wanted to comment about, death of child, loss of companionship with the death of the child. It's Washington that enacted this law.
Let me see.
457.
457.
Senator Lent said he was going to give you the name of the state, and I told him I have it, and I will pass it on to testify. It is Washington. Incidentally, the first lawsuit we tried on this in Washington, the jury came back with $2,000 more than the prayer. So it did make a considerable change in the verdicts. I have no other testimony on any of these. We have to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Dale Jacobs.
Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Dale Jacobs, and I practice law in Oregon City. Our firm handles all types of cases. My own particular contribution is primarily that in the defense area. I want to speak first about the Senate Bill 457, which, in my opinion, is the most dangerous of all these bills, from a defense standpoint at least, that Senator Lent has introduced. I think this bill would provide a windfall to the parents and to the committee, and I think it's outside of what has been said, the intent of damages are supposed to be. We've always followed the idea, especially in death cases, of a pecuniary loss on the part of a husband or a wife, why they limit it to those areas that are within the pecuniary laws. But this would, I honestly don't know what this means. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the Washington bill. But this says two more elements of damage can be incorporated. It says loss of love and companionship and for injury to the parent-child relationship. And I'm not sure what that means. And as I say, I haven't seen the Washington bill. If the damages on behalf of the child were to be enlarged, the parents, so that they could have what I described as a windfall, I think it ought to be examined more. I don't know what is a child here. It isn't defined, or maybe it does in the bill. It states the age, whether a child is an unmarried person under the age of 21 years, or what a child would be, or if there's any age involved. So I would just urge you, gentlemen, before seriously considering this bill, that it be examined further. When you get down to this part of giving thoughts on these things, you're kind of like in board your examination. You got juror 7, 8, 9, 10. You've asked all the other questions, and you're short, and this is what I'm going to do. Then most of the reasons that I had in mind have already been stated.
I'd like to ask a question about the one that you were talking about, since you're so interested in that. What's the beginning of the rule that there's no cause of action for a person who's dead? Is that Lord Campbell's case?
That was, Senator, that was in the wrongful death case where the Lord Campbell's at. And under that act, the cause of action died with a dead person, and then, of course, Reagan, the Wrongful Death Act, is in derogation of the common law. It's a revival statute.
Yes. That was on the theory originally that the cause of action, that nobody was hurt except the dead man.
That's right.
And what we're arguing here is that if the parent's hurt, you know, the child's dead, if the parent's hurt, then if he's not hurt in the way, well, we ought to pay.
Well, if there is a pecuniary loss in the sense of an economic loss, for example, if the child was supporting the parents, things of that nature, I think this would be a proper damage. But the thing I'm objecting to is just letting 12 people get emotionally involved in assessing a loss to a parent of a child for love and companionship and relationship. I think it's very dangerous. And no matter how far social reform might go and a lot of damages, I just can't.
But Mr. Jacobs, doesn't the law go a little farther than whether the child was supporting the parent or not? Isn't it actually whether the child was contributing to the household income?
Yes, I think this is true.
Which is are quite different things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is. Ed Smith talked about the Washington Bill, and I would like to look that bill over. I mean, that law and also that case. I can't imagine Washington.
I don't mean this to be a tractable question, but is it easier to collect for love and companionship of a dog that got run over than it is for a child?
I don't believe that there is a element of damage involved the death of a dog.
That's not the damage question.
Probably. Pardon? Senator Dernstadt.
Well, I need from my own information. What is the age? Is that consent here? Child 35 years old or down?
Oh, no,
one. Oh, sure. How far up the line?
A minor.
It has to be a minor.
And in Oregon, for a boy to marry, it's 21.
This uses the term child, and I assume minor child.
I think that's what's meant. You're still a child, either the son or daughter of your parents, when it comes to inheritance.
Yeah. But not for these purposes.
Well, I think that's right, but I think it's. Could I ask, Mr. Chairman, this witness, whether if we this kind of a concept is adopted, whether it would not be a good idea to put a limit on the death of a child, like we did on several years ago on the wrongful death?
Well, I would think in that instance, Senator, you're almost giving a blank check up to that amount.
Well, almost. I think that's what we did before, you know, on the wrongful death.
I can figure eliminating
but there certainly get so large much. Verdicts. There'll be many situations in which the death of a child, a very precocious child with 6 or 7 years of age, and the circumstances under which the accident happened are of such a nature as to stir up the emotions of people, you wouldn't actually be getting the same measure of damages in that case as you would in another mundane, ordinary type situation. So you wouldn't be compensating the parents alike, actually.
And
of course, they didn't before either.
You mean in the death cases?
Yeah.
No, that's true, but we look what we eventually did to it.
I know.
And I'm confident that the verdicts in a child's case would probably exceed those of the wage earner of the family. I just feel that 12 people getting emotionally involved in loss of a child, each puts his own self in that position.
How many states allow recovery for love and affection of a child?
I know of none.
Washington.
Now the next bill I want to make just a brief comment was on 477, and I too feel that it's a good bill except for permitting the parents to recover for loss of child services. Now, I say it from a plaintiff's standpoint here, gentlemen, for this reason, that if you get some greedy parents, and in most all these cases, there is an element of the monetary gain that the parents have, this probably would affect the amount allowed to the child. And I think
it's
477. And I think that it would be unfair to the child to let the greedy parent try to get his two bits out of this case, too, and it would reflect on the amount of the award of the child. I think that if this bill were, that part was eliminated, I'd hardly recommend it pass, as in practice would do it, and they all agree with that. On Senate Bill 481, I feel that's an excellent bill. Especially you, Senator, has been this practice law for many years. You know, you go back to your old affidavit. That's a good idea. You go back to your old affidavit's publication in the real estate piece. Now, those were the reasons for all this once a week for four consecutive weeks and all those things you had to get the affidavits in and due diligence and all this and that. They had a reason then. But the reason no longer exists, this is aside from what I think on this idea of having publications for once a month for four consecutive weeks, then waiting 6 months is a silly rule, but we have it now. And I don't know if there's a bill to change that or not. Now, our due diligence under this was copied from the old idea of due diligence under your mortgage foreclosures and suits to quiet title and that sort of
thing.
Well,
not as it appears now.
Not as it appears now. This is why I think it's a good bill.
I've had many suits to quiet title where the affidavit that we submitted to the judge, he found me insufficient in that we didn't go into a complete detail for
direct
pages.
Knocking on doors.
And I finally got into the habit of time and place and who to talk to.
But this just makes, this is just to correct that one thing of due diligence, and I think it's an excellent idea. That's all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next person we have,
Mr. Burney.
George Burney.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is George Burney. I'm a lawyer from Portland, and I represent the American Insurance Association, which is a trade association of capital stock companies, and opposed to all of these bills, including 481. Jerry Mendel represents the American Mutual Insurance Alliance, and his companies are also opposed. He's unable to attend this hearing because of being able to report the committee of labor and management, and asked me to report that fact to the committee. The reason why I've been assigned to discuss 481 is because it does involve really the law of negligence. And as most of you know, I practice no negligence law at all. I've been in any case in the court or the plaintiff's case. So I'm talking now about service assignments. And the testimony given to you by the former witness does not represent the case of my clients or Mendel's clients. Now, we feel that Senate Bill 481, that the attempts to water down the requirements concerning the diligence exercised by the plaintiff attempting to serve some of the defendants would be just opening the doors to less effort to find the defendants in the first place. Now, remember, this is substituted service, and this is something less than actual service, and it's limited to cases involving the use of the highway. Perhaps we have here a case where a group of citizens give a special treatment in contradiction to our statutes or our Constitution. The decisions that were referred to by Berkeley Lent in Carroll versus Redding, a 1968 decision, that's when Judge Redding was sued to demand damage to quash a service summons, which the Supreme Court said should be quashed. Senator Lent said that the party ought to be able to rely on an address given to him by the defendant at the scene of the accident. Well, I don't know if that's true. And we feel that the Supreme Court decision says that the affidavit must show the extent to which the plaintiff exercised due diligence in attempting to find the defendant. It's not an abuse of the extent to which a diligence must be exercised. To amend this statute, to simply say that all you have to do is to ring a doorbell or write a letter to the most recent address furnished by the defendant, seems to us to be not quite enough. We feel that that due diligence should be that which is stated by the former legislative assembly and by our Supreme Court to be that quantum of effort necessary to ascertain the whereabouts of the defendant.
George, how do you react toward Senator Lentz's testimony in a case, and I believe it was Senator Lentz or somebody, in a case where service, where the letter was actually received, and yet the motion to quash was filed after the expiration of the statute of limitations? Now, certainly there isn't anything equitable about that.
Well, perhaps not, Mr. Chairman, but wouldn't that same situation obtain in other than an automobile accident?
Yeah.
In any other negligence? So why didn't they just appear? Now, if the fact that the defendant received the letter doesn't necessarily mean that he received it in writing.
No, of course not.
And he does have actual notice, but if we're going to preserve our statutory requirement that to give order to court jurisdiction on these personal matters, that the defendant has to be personally served, and then to depart from that only in cases where he consents to the appointment of the Department of Motor Vehicles in these instances of substitute service, I just feel that we're just leaning over too far in the direction of the guy using the highways.
Well, the law as it exists is rather general as to the amount of effort that has to be exerted in ordinary cases. And, of course, it's up to the discretion of the court in those cases, except up on appeal. Now, do you feel that it would be wrong in this case? This is an isolated group of cases. Do you think it would be wrong to spell out a little more exactly what the plaintiff must do, rather than go to the broad rule that we have as the service of summons?
Well, I would think that the plaintiffs would be better served by keeping the present law than they would by any further delineation of what must be done in order to ascertain the whereabouts of the defendant. I think we should leave that with the discretion of the courts and have the court determine whether or not that effort shown by the plaintiff in his affidavit is a sufficient effort.
Well, there isn't anything definitive
here. No, there isn't. But it's like this question of whether or not a witness, the trial should be postponed because of the absence of an expert witness. That is being left to the discretion of the court. I think this is a proper area of discretion. It's not definitive. And I think that by making it defending, we may be digging ourselves into a deeper hole.
Senator Wilner.
If the defendant was actually innocent, and where his carrier appears,
his carrier appears?
Insurance carrier appears by special settlements. In that situation, at least,
you mean a general appearance is made?
No, you're talking about a special appearance.
No,
talks to someone.
No, I'm asking about, I'm analogizing from the Bankruptcy Act, where when you have actual notice, when the defendant has actual notice, that from that point on he cannot complain about the insufficiency of the affidavit. Now, certainly, if a carrier shows up and makes and files an appearance, whether it be special or general, certainly they're conceding actual notice.
Had actual notice at the time of that accident, the lawsuit would probably be filed.
No, they can say actual notice that the of the receipt of the.
You mean add another thing to it?
Oh, I was going to ask two questions. Sure. One question: I am bothered by a provision in law which you wish to determine retroactively whether you did it right, saving you were concerned about before. I'm asking you, as a way of curing problem I'm bothered about, and assuming you don't like the language the way it is, I want to like his comments on two things. One, a provision saying actual notice of the filing of a complaint is sufficient, or may be listing what steps the defendant, the plaintiff has to do. Mm-hmm. If this step that listed in this proposal is not sufficient, what other steps should be sufficient?
Well,
these are several questions. Let's
yeah.
Talk one by one.
Well, Senator, remember now in this Carroll versus Reddy case, the plaintiff went to the business associate of the defendant that says, my associates moved to Reno. And so they filed an affidavit saying that, and the Supreme Court said it wasn't valid. Now, I don't know whether we should permit a plaintiff to enjoy the benefits of substituted service, where, for example, he merely goes to a neighbor or to a business associate and finds out from that neighbor or business associate that the defendant has moved out of the jurisdiction. I think the law should impose upon him a duty to go forward a little bit further anyway.
All right, now, how far?
Well, I don't know how far. I would think he would, maybe by writing a letter to the defendant, he has an address for it. Certainly might be a forwarding address. And getting in communication with his relatives, or bringing a letter of communication from the defendant who is in Reno, saying, I'm here and you guys can't get me. Something like that. Go a little farther than we're going here.
Would you have any objection if we try to spell out a series of steps?
I have no objection. I'm sure my comment
is not. The objection is really not to in being specific, but that this is not, doesn't go far.
Yeah, we just think so. Yeah, and ring the doorbell and say he's defending here. No, he's not. It's not sufficient.
Right. And the other thing is, do you think if there's an actual notice of filing? Then it could not be able to attack the affidavit.
How would you prove that filing the notice? I'm not too clear on that. I mean, the actual receiving the actual notice by registered mail.
Well, in a I'm analogizing a situation where a creditor who was not listed on the bankruptcy petition does not file a claim, sits back, waits until the discharge. Then filed on his original claim, and the defense is raised by the bankrupt. Oh, yes, he had actual notice. And of course, he got it before the Supreme Court.
Well, I would think, I don't know how actual notice can be proven. I'm not familiar with the bankruptcy procedure. But in this type of case, involving the use of the audit, the actual notice would depend upon the letter.
Well, I mean, if the insurance company comes in with a motion to quash, very especially a motion to quash the service. They can actually notice.
So the insurance company has. So not the defendant. Just say that the complaint and summons was mailed to the business associate's address. So he says, well, yeah, I guess it was the insurance company. And the defendant has no notice at all.
Send your husband.
How much difference does this statute?
Suggestions could probably be worked into something.
Did you have any comments on any of the others?
Nothing.
Is there anyone else present that wishes to testify in connection with any of these bills? I don't seem to have any others signed up. Not me either.
April 15th, Senate Bill 506, proposed probate code, followed by a work session.
An article called miscellaneous provision, and it primarily consists of amendments to sections which are outside of the present probate code and outside of the proposed probate code. Many of the amendments are just intended to adjust them to changes in probate code. 263 is a section which presently deals with the situation of the circuit court judge acting as a circuit court judge in certain cases. The amendment merely eliminates the specific provision subsection 2 thereof, dealing with the district court judge exercising powers and duties in circuit court judge and probate. That is generally covered in one of the earlier sections in the code in somewhat more detail as to the district judge exercising these powers. It's felt that this provision, insofar as it related to probate, should be in the probate code and not in this section.
Okay.
Section 264 amends an existing statute dealing with the transfer of all judicial jurisdiction from county courts to circuit courts.
Am I right to assuming that these, the county, everybody's agreeable with which counties do what? Is everybody in Eastern Oregon satisfied with which counties are?
Oh, yes.
That's all the compromise
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
No, no problem with that.
Section 264 amends ORS section, which has received the transfer of all judicial jurisdictions from county courts to certain counties. The amendment deletes the specific provision that has applied to this county for a number of years, which will note the transfer of all jurisdictions except probate. Under the probate code proper, all probate jurisdictions will be in the circuit court of this county. So subsection 2 is eliminated. This county is added on line 20 on page 111. Section 265 amends a section in the chapter on the judicial common courts, and it amends it to refer to a provision in the probate code proper, whereby provision is made for the transfer of an estate proceeding in those counties in which the county court has this jurisdiction to the circuit court, and eliminate from this particular section the detail on the probate matters in this circumstance because it is covered in section 8 on the probate code proper. Section 266 amends another section in chapter 5. Primarily because the reference to ORS 5.040, you see there on line 20, which is drafted out, that section is being appealed. Something had to be substituted. Instead of perpetuating, for example, probate business, which many decided to put in judicial business, because as you know, a county court does have other judicial business than probate in some counties. It still has juvenile in some counties. It still has commitment in some counties. So it's clarified law. Section 267 amends an ORS section merely to eliminate the reference to a 3.130, which was previously amended, because now more circuit courts than those which are specified in 3.130 will have the probate jurisdiction, and the reference is no longer applicable. Technically, the section will apply only to those circuit courts which have the probate jurisdiction. Section 268 is a provision relating to the statute of limitations and the effect of the death restriction on that statute of limitations. And you will note that there are two changes in this section. One, in line 33 of 112, the deletion of the words and the cause of action survives. 67 session 65, the statute was enacted that provided that all causes of action survive. So this is how it is now. Second, you will note, top of page 113, that the cause of action if the statute of limitations has expired, there is 1 year after the death of the decedent to commence the action against the personal representative. This 1 year extension, if it is the case, applies coincides with a provision in the probate code proper that relates to the claims against the court on the 1 year after death. Section 269 deals with not the commencement of actions and suits, but the continuation of actions and suits which have been begun before the death of the decedent, and as well before the disability of the decedent or the transfer of an interest. Since the section did involve a decedent's estate, although written by relatives too, the committee thought that it should be adjusted. And you will note that present provisions continue, the action doesn't abate either by the death or disability or the transfer. In the case of death, we have the new provisions. The court on motion may allow the suit to be continued by the personal representative at any time within 1 year after its death, that again conforms to the 1 year period, or against the personal representative, someone else is bringing the action suit, at any time within 4 months after the date of publication.
Is that a substantive change?
The time period, that 4 months, is a substantive change, and it was put in because of the general 4 month period which has been used on filing claims for priorities and testing of the 4 months have been used most commonly. That's why they picked 4 months.
Saying you're representing one match, you bring an injury claim against the deceased more than after the estate is closed. There is a procedure for opening up.
There is a procedure for opening up.
So what's the impact of it? If you opened up, however, then you're still bound by the statute.
In other words, if I don't know whether you're going to have an opening up situation, here your action or suit had to be dropped before the estate was opened up in the first place. The action or suit was dropped before, in this case, the defendant, the action was brought, the defendant died. The action or suit does not abate by the death.
Yes.
But you have to go in and
change over. You're still living the 1 year statute for the new action.
That's right. Section 270 relates to, as I recall, the exemption from execution. It referred to the section of line 33 of page 113, bracketed out references to two present statutes that are repealed by the proposed probate code. Those are the homestead statutes for Social Support. And those are repealed. That's the only reason the section is amended. Section 271, section in the present chapter on evidence. The primary purpose for this amendment is to delete a reference to 114.050.
What a dramatic state treasurer we have. I have it on the job sentence.
Go on ahead,
Which is repealed by the probate code proper. 114.050 relates to the borrower.
Mr. Chairman, the record shows he's in the wrong room to vote.
We beg your pardon.
Well, I should hope so.
Not interrupt.
The OR section deleted here is the section which provides for the oral program appeal by the seamen and soldiers. That is not perpetuated in the section itself. Section 272 amends the section of the district court law primarily for the same purpose that we amended the section on the circuit court law to delete that provision relating to Coos County because all program jurisdiction will now be in the circuit court in Coos County. Here you see the district court, all of that jurisdiction is transferred to the circuit court in Coos. Section 273 Merely amends and section the tenants from the real property law to delete the reference to tenancy by a conspiracy which will no longer exist. The same is true for section 230.274, the deletion of an existing reference to tenancy by a conspiracy. Section 275, although you'll see a number of amendments early in the section, the basic reason for the amendment of this section 93190 is the deletion of the last sentence there on 19 and 21. It refers to vacancies in executiveship, and it also refers to the county court. There are detailed and committee thought adequate provisions for filling vacancies in the office of personal representative in the probate court proper, and this sentence is unnecessary and might very well conflict with those provisions. Section 276 deals with a section again in the real property statutes, dealing with the deferred installments, purchase price when there are two or more people to join the sellers in contract for sale. Primary purpose of the amendment is to delete subsection 2 thereof, which deals with the instance where the two or more sellers involved on a situation where there is a dollar in courtesy situation. Page 116, lines 13 and 14, I note that the committee has also deleted subsection 4 in the statement that this section being declared for the existing law lies retrospectively. I frankly don't exactly know why it was deleted, except that I have in the back of my mind, the committee may have been thinking about a case not too long ago, which the Supreme Court decided that the legislature had not put these things in the statutes, and they were going to pay any attention to it anyhow. So you may remember that particular instance. That's the only thing I recall on.
Well, I think it's all right to delete it. Mm-hmm. I don't see how it can conflict or cause any problems. Do you,
No, it doesn't conflict. It's a question, basically a question of whether a law of this nature could have been made effective retrospectively.
Do you think we should leave that language in?
Oh, I think the committee probably had a really good reason for saying that. I just don't know precisely what it was, and this is the only thing that occurred to me this evening looking at it, was why they probably did. They thought it was
a good reason.
They thought it had no effect anyhow, I would say.
Old Bob Bennett, not new Bob Bennett.
Section 277, again, amend a section of real property law providing for the execution of deed by the judge where a personal representative or guardian of the servant fails is unable to do it. The primary words deleted in line 25 authorizing the sale in all cases, of course, under the probate code, there will not be a specific court order authorizing the sale. And it was decided to broaden it somewhat, and the other suggestion for 4 million proceeding to pending.
Section 277?
Yes.
With respect to that, by the way, Senator Burns said to tell you, yep. Do we have some circuit courts in the state that exercise probate jurisdiction? Do we not, whether in multiple judge districts? Well, we have lots of one say, and where the by law probate is not fixed in one particular department.
The only circuit court in which there is a probate department under statute is in one of those.
Well, that's why I'm wondering if. The deed may be executed by the judge before whom the proceeding is pending, or by his successor. Why couldn't it be any judge, would they?
I think it could in Moloma anyhow. Couldn't any judge in the circuit court in Moloma have a probate jurisdiction or something?
They are always very careful, the clerk, to stamp
if somebody else does it in the absence of the judge in the probate court, because it's a statutory law.
But I think the probate jurisdiction is given in law bond to the whole circuit court, and it really says that the probate business should be handled.
No, but what I'm getting is not my own. So I'm getting the cases in, like Lane and Marion, where they've just assigned them themselves to one, and, well, yeah, I suppose it's not that important.
Well, it might be.
I assume by his successor, they mean here, if it's under the judge's email or somebody else.
Whether he died or not, if the presiding judge or one of the multiple judges decided to assign somebody else to leave, I think he'd be a successor.
Section 278 amends the section in the Torrens law. It's amended very often.
Gordon, do you have any registrations of the Torrens Act?
I don't.
Maybe it's a really early. I got a Dennis Smith. I've got my life coming to get some property out from under the Torrens Act. You know what I'm doing?
Well, I don't have an antitrust act.
Section 279 amends a section dealing with the right to control the disposition of the name of the receipt. The purpose of the amendment, the committee felt that there were some instances in which, for example, they couldn't find a surviving spouse or children or parents or a person next degree of kindred.
10 days,
he says. 10 days, the garbage collector.
is that
included within the 10 days after the undertaker gets hold of
him? The date of death, I think 10 days would be too late.
Is there any conflict between this and a bill that's in the legislation now?
Yes, the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act.
Yeah.
You've got Senate Bill 109, House Bill 1158,
conflicting both of them. All right. How could we amend this to conform with 1158?
It may be. I was touching the timing on the thing.
Well, 1158 is the vehicle that we're going to act on here.
Chapter so-and-so, roads, hospital.
Well, we can make the adjustment now. If I can assume that the changes will be made in the amendment of 97-130 and 1158, if you decide to change some of the provisions.
Well, we'll get to 1158 tonight.
This is, of course, always with our timing and wanting to get this bill over to the House. This is always an amendment which could be put in the House.
Yeah.
This is true. I think
that's right. This is Senate.
We're going to have to catch some of these on the House side anyhow, I think.
All right. Pardon for us.
But you will note that in the event family members can't be found, and either the public health officer or the special administrator. And you recall the discussion of the special administrator in the program. Well, this is one of the purposes we want a special administrator or the personal representative himself. How do we get to take the time to then offer out this position? Section 280 amends a provision which is now in the probate code. But it was the thought of the committee that would be desirable since this relates so closely to present provisions of the law which we have for the gift of bodies and scientific and medical purposes. This should not be in the probate order. It should be with the provisions for the gift. Again, this is another section that conflicts with your Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. House Bill 1158. Should be adjusted at the same time as the previous section. Not the only changes that are actually made there on the substitution of personal representative from the secretary. Section 281, here we get into another area of real property. And during the amendment 105, we'll take you to delete reference to recovery of dollars before then?
Amended this thing.
Yes, but.
Action to do what?
Action, by the time you come, real property has projects. You can't act, action for negligent injury there.
Well, no.
But it doesn't make any sense to the partition.
Well, put back the word for the bracket and then it doesn't add anything.
Yeah.
I don't think by deleting those words, we're taking away any blame.
Is that true?
Well, it may be desirable to look at the context of this kind of section. It may have sections on both sides of the garden kind of action.
Well, there's several different reasons to sue a co-tenant.
Yeah, not all of them have anything to do with the property.
Well, this particular section has to do with the property, because it talks about possession and something else.
It's an action by against the co-tenant. It obviously, the plaintiff has shown additional evidence of his right to possession, the defendant either denied the plaintiff's right to possession. In other words, supposing action includes everything here. Suppose I've got a suit to partition. Do I have to prove that he denied me possession or something in order to get partition?
No, I suggested a minute ago you look at the answer no, because there's another statute on what you do with partition. I'm sure this is declaratory of old common law rights or old common law requirements. And that the only time that you would apply it is if you were having to do with the right to possession or the title to the property. I don't think that if he ran over you with his automobile, that you would have to prove Oster.
It's true that in a chapter on action, there are part on actions for recovery of real property.
I think this really means that any action relating to the right of possession, ownership, or other rights relating to the property.
I'm sure that's really what is meant. The only reason I don't immediately jump at Senator Lent's suggestion is I don't remember enough property law to make me want to feel secure and fiddling around with it.
You know what the last guy did when the president voted on this?
Tell me.
A widow and co-tenant shall prove ouster. Chairman and co-tenant shall prove ouster.
Yeah, and they got rid of the widow because they got rid of the doubt. I think this has to do with the original writ of mort de season.
I'll be the first to admit I don't know what the damn section means.
Well, it obviously means in any action concerning the property. But why don't we add into it, related to the property?
Well, because I'm not so sure as how
the Bob, would you check into that?
I'm not sure all the way to us about the suits to partition and so on concerning the property.
I think there's another statute for how you go about partition, what I was trying to say.
You mean between, there's a chapter on partition in the end of the code.
It's a statutory.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is not the probate code, Don, that we're dealing with here. This is a property.
105050.
Yeah, sorry, 105050. That's what I was just reading. But it is right there, except for these words. Some part of probate.
Well, I don't see how we could hurt this. If we would provide in any action relating to possession, ownership, or other rights of the property.
Well, then we pass.
I'm sure that it's just a real old requirement that you have to prove ouster to get into court.
Why do we fool around with this if we don't know what we're doing?
Well, then what do you suggest we do?
I just need one.
I guess I'm not hurting anything by helping there.
Well, what if one co-tenant sues another one for a tenant in common of real property, personal injury?
Well, I suppose they take it in the context that it's in action.
Well, then I'd say we should deal with one. Property. Okay, Doctor.
Section 282 amends a provision which is in the petition of real property. Primarily, you'll note in the belief on line 33 of 117, the reference to the inchoate right of balance, which has been eliminated.
baseline between line one. Section 283, amend a section in the municipal relations tab. It's a very long section. The only purpose of the amendment appears on page 119, line 16. The deletion of the reference place. Section 107, by the way, is amended by the intermediate field court bill. And to digress, you will note when you get into the appeals court bill that it refers to appeals and probate. So that it's, that particular bill, conflicts with this one not only as to amending four of the same sections that are amended or repealed by this bill, but it also has some substance which you may want to consider in connection with the probate appeal. Keep in mind when you do that, that the intermediate appellate takes effect on July 1 of this year. The probate court bill takes effect a year later. There are some problems in hearing these two together.
Same about the American solution.
I will, if I may, point out some of the conflicts as we go along, because this committee has multiple bills that conflict with this. Section 284 on page 120 amends another section relating to the nominal board. The only change is the deletion of the material on lines 22 and 23 in reference to the decree of the nominal on the divorce, revoking the will. If you recall, we have detailed provisions in the probate court itself on the effect of a annulment or a divorce. And this bill is this ORS 107-110, also one of those amended by the Court of Appeals. Well, it's also amended by another bill, which you have 1332, which is strictly a domestic relations type bill. I believe it goes to the marital status aspect of this particular section. Section 285 amends a provision in the domestic relations chapter, this time relating to the separation proceeding, and deletes, as you know, on that section, the last sentence, a reference to the court decreeing a dower and courtesy as well as homestead rights and the collective share are extinguished and barred. Dower and courtesy, of course, is without under the probate court, as are the homestead rights. And we have some discussion on the effect of the election, but the bill as it stands now, to extinguish the adjustment or bar of the elected share of the surviving spouse of the probate court. Section 286, we get into a couple of sections in the adoption chapter. Primarily, the amendment of this particular section of ORS was intended for, as I recall, two or three reasons. One, the committee felt that the effect of the decree of adoption should not depend upon whether the decree was given by the state or according to another state. They lead on line 31, page 121, in reference to only the decree of the court of this state. The other deletions are primarily to subsection 3 on lines 11 and 12, page 122. But this provision, which is in the adoption law, does not affect intestate succession under the probate code, which is dealt with in some detail in the probate code itself. Section 287, the only change on it appears at the top of page 123, line 2. You'll note that the deletion of ORS section, which is in the probate code, which is repealed,
deals with the manner of publication of service of plantation. In lieu of that repeal ORS section, the committee substituted a reference to the general provisions in Chapter 15 for the service or publication of the citation interactions and suits generally. The same applies in Section 288, another amendment, the reference to the ORS section of the Federal Code repealed and substituted therefore. Section 289 deals now with the appeal in adoption cases. And you'll recall, and this gets into the matter of jurisdiction, you'll recall that in a number of instances, the probate court as such is given jurisdiction in adoption and in commitment, as well as probate itself. Now, since we still have the county court of six counties with probate jurisdictions, it's necessary to make some adjustments in adoption proceedings, especially in the case of appeal, and a couple of sections we will see later on relating to the commitment, providing for the different situation as to where you're circuit court has probate jurisdictions and therefore adoption of the commitment, or your county court has probate and therefore adoption of the commitment. And this merely perpetuates what we've done in the probate court itself, but in the county court, we can still have adoption in those cases where it has probate jurisdictions. We appeal those in the circuit court. The circuit court has, of course, those circuit courts. Section 178,
how much?
Excuse me, Section 290, amending ORS 178-08, primarily to delete page 124, lines 27 through 30, a reference to the county clerk's reporting title to the receipt station and remained open. This provision has been carried over as a new provision in the probate code itself. The feeling was that this should be in the probate code.
Didn't we discuss this the other day?
This particular provision?
Well, this subject matter.
Yeah, in this cheat section, the main change you made is that the attempt to get it back is before the state treasurer.
Yeah, we did discuss this case. The equivalent provision in the probate code for deleted subsection 6 is section 191 on page 71, by the way. There the report goes not to the state treasurer, but to the division of the line. Part
of
the procedure.
Senator Light.
Matter of passing interest. If I get this matter of fact to someone in the state treasurer, make examinations to the dockets, all of course, other than at the Supreme Court. Anybody can put the docket in the court. I'm not sure if the Supreme Court is sacrosanct.
I don't think there's anything in the docket in the Supreme Court that you can't find out about.
It's such a fun part. I may be wrong, but things are really silly.
This chapter hasn't been amended since the ORS was enough. And for all I know, it hasn't been changed very often.
Well,
it's here.
Nothing I want to get into today.
Okay, 291.
291 and the three sections that follow, you'll notice, are presently in Chapter 120, which is part of the probate code. In the preliminary draft that the committee prepared last fall, these were sections which were in a part of Article 2, which was the planning of the chief. However, on examination of these three sections, 292, 293, and 294, we discover that they don't really relate to the escheat of property belonging to deceased persons. They relate to the escheat of patients or inmates committed to state institutions. It was the feeling of the committee that these provisions should not be, for that reason, in the program. And therefore, you know, they're adding to the main part chapter 179, which is the basic chapter relating to border control and a number of other matters relating generally to the institutions under the authority of the border control. And primarily the amendments, there are, for example, to delete the reference to the land board and substitute the division of state lands. They delete a reference to the common school fund, and under the constitutional provisions now all the children go to the common school fund anyhow. And basically, these three provisions will be in a chapter relating to the state institutions and the patients now, and not in COVID, so the cause of this problem. Section 298, amended section of the Juvenile Court Law. The only change appears on line 10 of page 128.